From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Heat can be so welcome. Heat can be so overwhelming. My guest today, Bill Strever, has tracked it all. The heat we love, heat that kills us, heat beyond imagining. He's here to tell the tale. This hour On Point, we're talking about heat and humans. You can join the conversation. Do you flock to it, flee it? What's been your most dramatic encounter with heat? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Anchorage, Alaska, Bill Strever, biologist and author of the new book, Heat, Adventures in the World's Fiery Places. Bill, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
What kind of dateline is that, Anchorage, Alaska, for a book on heat?
Well, you know, it's the perfect dateline. People that live up here in the cold regions spend a lot of time thinking about things like staying warm.
I guess so. Better have that fire somewhere. This is really a fun tour. I mean, you touch on so many aspects of heat. We'll look at it, but take us first to Harry Houdini and that fiery cage where he's in a cage, what, they would light it up. There's a beefsteak involved. We learn a lot about the nuance, the subtlety of heat that Harry Houdini knew. Tell us, Bill.
Yeah. Well, Harry Houdini did some interesting things. You know, most people think of Houdini as an escape artist, but he was sort of a performer of all types. And among his performances was tricks with fire. So one thing he had was a fire cage, and the idea was you would wrap this cage in cloth, and you would have oil on the cloth, and you would crawl inside the cage, and you'd be standing there as you being Harry Houdini or one of his trainees.
Yeah.
We hope, yeah. And someone lights the cage on fire. So this raging fire goes around you. And the trick is that you lay down in the fire cage. So you're low in the fire cage. You're also wearing a sort of an asbestos cape that you pull over your head and face. The stake is, you've taken a stake in with you, and the stake is up above you in the thick of the heat. And as the flames burn down, you stand up, people see you, and you come out with this cooked steak, and you yourself are not cooked.
And, magic, miracle.
Magic and miracle, that's right. And I was talking to a friend of mine who's a firefighter just Saturday, and he was telling me about crawling into buildings. And as he's crawling along in the building, he's doing the same trick that Houdini does. He's wearing his fire protective gear, and he's crawling along, and it's about 300 degrees on his hands and knees. And if he stands up, he says his helmet and faceplate would melt in the heat just by standing up.
I was struck reading through here, Bill, at how in many ways we all live this Houdini-style life. I mean, we are surrounded in our greater environment by sources of tremendous heat, whether inside our own planet or coming at us from the sun or in all kinds of processes that we use in industry and even just for comfort. If you get close enough to it, there's killer heat around us all the time.
Oh, absolutely, all the time. Even your car, right? I mean, your car really works by expanding, gases expanding because they're hot, right? Drives the pistons.
Last time you were with us, you were talking about cold. Maybe you just that was too chilly for an Alaskan address. I know that's your home. What brought you to heat?
Well, you know, I had so much fun with cold, and I just wanted to keep walking right up the thermometer. It made perfect sense to me. I mentioned it to my editor, and his first response was, you know, credibility for cold is right there, living in Alaska, working in the Arctic, et cetera, but credibility for heat, and I said the same thing I just said to you. Look, if you live in Alaska, you spend a lot of time thinking about heat. But plus, heat's just, it's a great story. You know, heat, first of all, it crosses a much wider range than cold. So if you start with sort of room temperature or temperatures that, where humans are comfortable, and you go downwards, you pretty quickly bump up against absolute zero.
Mm-hmm. Or 400 degrees or something down there.
I think it's about minus 470 Fahrenheit, mm-hmm. I think. Mm-hmm. You start with, which seems like a long way, and it's cold.
Yes.
There's no doubt it's cold,
yes,
down there. It's,
yes,
a very different world than we live in. But you start with heat. You start at room temperature, and you can march up the thermometer to trillions of degrees. And, in fact, we don't know how high up the thermometer you can go. The Planck temperature was once thought to be the hottest possible temperature, and that was sort of 10 to the 32nd degrees Fahrenheit. So it was tremendously hot temperature that existed at the birth of the universe. So a huge, huge range of temperatures to cross and to play with and to think about.
And these aren't just at the birth of the universe. I mean, you remind us with super colliders and nuclear blasts, humans can create extremely high temperatures of heat.
Well, we have a long way to go. The Planck temperature is way, way hotter than anything we've come close to. But humans have reached 7 trillion degrees Fahrenheit or maybe even a bit more than that. And they do that, as you just mentioned, in supercolliders. So it's a simple thing. If you have a supercollider and you're a brilliant physicist working with a team of brilliant engineers and brilliant physicists, you strip the electrons from gold nuclei. You accelerate those nuclei to very, very close to the speed of light, some going clockwise and some going counterclockwise in two different tunnels. And then you cross those tunnels so that those nuclei collide. And when those nuclei collide, and not just a glancing blow, but a head-on collision, imagine a head-on collision with a very massive nuclei, smashes into one another, and it obliterates itself. It creates temperatures that have been measured at over 7 trillion degrees. And things that we think of as matter cease to exist. Even protons and neutrons don't exist at that temperature. So you get this quark gluon soup, they call it. And it has very, very strange characteristics that were totally unpredicted by the theoretical physicists before these experiments were done.
You know, 7 trillion degrees just boggles the mind. And yet, and it's much more of a range than we can think of or produce with cold. And yet you remind us that our human capacity for interaction with heat is actually much narrower than with cold. I mean, the body temperature can drop even 40 degrees below normal. And there are, you know, records of people surviving that. But you see, a temperature increase of less than 10 degrees above normal, deadly for humans.
Deadly, absolutely right.
So our range of interaction with heat, our healthy interaction with it, is pretty strictly constrained.
Well, that's true in a way, but of course it's also true that we come in contact with heat that's reasonably hot, over 1,000 degrees. We can do that through things like firewalking or even just sticking your head in a hot oven. It might be 400, 500 degrees very, very briefly. It wouldn't be comfortable. But so we do have some interactions, but our body temperature, absolutely, you can't let your core temperature raise more than 10 degrees. It's deadly.
Give us a sense of how humans have understood heat and what it is over time.
Yeah, you know, that was another interesting thing about this journey. And, you know, when I started this journey, I'm a scientist, but I'm not a physicist. I didn't really know the history of the field. And I was very surprised to find out how recently science came to think of heat as molecular motion. And now, of course, every kid in school, probably in grade school, it's intuitive to them that if things are hot, that means the molecules are bouncing around more quickly, and the hotter something is, the more quickly those molecules are moving around. We didn't really know that until the 1800s. Prior to that, people thought of heat as a subtle fluid, it was sometimes called, and they thought of conceptualized sort of pouring heat from a hot object to a cold object. And they also thought of cold as a subtle fluid of a different kind at one period of history. And bear in mind that at this time, these are not stupid people, you know, that they just didn't have the good fortune that we have in having had other people figure this out for us. So these weren't stupid people. They were doing things like inventing steam engines and doing things with heat that had never been done before. And yet they didn't understand the very basic physics, the very basic model that we use to understand heat now, which is an expression of molecular motion.
You talk about the French scientist who, I mean, as you say, no fool, he named oxygen and hydrogen, and yet he was still going with this subtle fluid idea that it was, by fluid, did he actually mean some kind of liquid?
Well, they specifically used the word fluid, or at least it was translated from the French as fluid. And I think he understood it was not a conventional liquid or a conventional fluid. But they were scratching around for ways to understand the world, and this was at a time when lots and lots of new ideas were appearing, much like our own time with technologies that are appearing every day, every month, every year, some major breakthrough. But back then it was on more basic fronts, like how heat works in this case. So no, I don't think he thought it was a fluid that you could simply pour, but he would observe things like you place a hot piece of iron next to a cold piece of iron, and somehow that heat flows from the hot piece to the cold piece, and you wind up with two warm pieces of iron. And to his eyes, that was, hey, look, it's some sort of a fluid flowing from one to the other.
What was the eureka moment that took people toward molecular motion rather than subtle fluid?
You know, I don't know that it was a eureka moment. There were lots of things going on that it was more of an evolution of ideas, as far as I can understand. I don't think it was a eureka moment, but one key observation was the reality that in some circumstances you could empty something of its fluid, not add any more fluid to it, and yet you would have more heat. And I think the most commonly used example of that is from friction. So there's a story told of cannon boring, and I think this was Count Rutherford that did this. He had a cannon boring machine set up in a barrel of water, and the cannon was cold when it started, and as they bored the cannon, the friction would create heat and would eventually boil the water. So that suggested that no one was pouring more fluid, no one was pouring this heat fluid into the cannon, and yet something was happening to make it hotter. And then later people talked about things like banging a hammer against an anvil and how that would create heat. And I think that gradually led to the idea that this must have something to do with particle motion.
Bill Strieber has followed heat all over the place, to volcanoes, the sun, flamethrowers, thermonuclear weapons, the Death Valley, and beyond. He writes it all up in his new book, Heat: Adventures in the World's Fiery Places. There's an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Joins us from chilly, cold Anchorage, Alaska today. Bill, stand by there. Here's Turn on the Heat from the Charleston Chasers. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Turn on the heat, starting to strut, wiggle and wobble and steam up the hut. Oh, oh, it's 30 below. Turn on the heat, 50 degrees, get hot for mama, or mama will freeze. Oh, oh, start melting the snow.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour, in the middle of winter, about heat, what it is, where we find it, how much we can take, with Bill Strieber. His new book is Heat: Adventures in the World's Fiery Places, and he has been all over looking for the heat, experiencing the heat. Excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Bill Strieber joins us today from Anchorage, Alaska. Bill, we asked our listeners on Facebook and beyond about the hottest places that they'd ever been or worked. And, I mean, people have experienced this all over the place. You know, Kevin, five decks down in a naval aircraft carrier checking weapons magazines. That sounds hot. David says Kuwait in the summer. Nancy says, I've walked on fire, been to some hot places, would take heat over cold any day of the week. Gary says Xi'an, China's furnace. What about you, Bill? For this book, what's the hottest place you got to?
Oh, boy, that's a good question. Well, the hottest place I got to was probably the Brookhaven Superglider in Brookhaven, New York, which is an hour and a half north of New York City, and that's one of the places, or the first place, where they reached temperatures of 7 trillion degrees.
Okay, but you didn't walk into there. What about the hottest heat that you actually experienced, yeah. I guess I should say?
Probably, Death Valley felt the hottest, but I also did firewalking, and of course you're up against the coals when you firewalk, so I would say firewalking for the absolute temperature, but Death Valley in summer for the overwhelming feeling of heat and the discomfort of heat.
Describe that experience for us. What month was it? How hot was it? How did you feel in it?
Well, as I remember, it was in July. It was, I think we were seeing temperatures in the shade of around 126, 127, if I remember right. It was hot, and that was temperatures in the shade. We were walking in the sun, mm-hmm. and it's, intentionally. I mean, you know, we wanted to have a look around Death Valley. We also were there as, and when I say we, myself and my companion, my wife, were there exploring heat for the book. So we wanted the full experience. So we're out in the sun, and I'm wandering around, and I have an infrared thermometer that I can point at things and get temperature readings. So I could point at a rock and find out very quickly how hot the rock was, or I could point the thermometer into my car, into my rental car that had been sitting in the sun for 3 hours, and get a temperature reading that as I remember, was over 180 degrees on the car seat.
People have such vivid memories of those experiences, those exposures to high heat. Jennifer writes to us. She says, hottest place I've ever been, the Valley of Fire just outside Las Vegas, Nevada, June, 106 in the shade. We jumped out of the car for 30 seconds, took our pictures, ran back to the air conditioning. Aaron, driving through the Mojave in July on I-40, hot enough to start my car's fuel boiling out of the gas cap. About 114, according to the car's dashboard. Who knows? Liz, hottest was near Death Valley, so hot that the soles of my desert boots melted and became gummy on the rocks. What about humans and how they deal with that? I mean, we've got large well, we've got significant populations of humans who have thrived in desert settings, Bill.
Well, absolutely. And humans, you know, we evolved in a very hot climate. We're very good sweaters. Some animals are good sweaters. Some animals aren't good sweaters. Mammals, of course, I'm talking about mammals or sweaters. Mm. But humans sweat very well. So as long as we have lots of water and we don't push ourselves too far, we can do quite well in the heat. We may not like it, especially if we're accustomed to air conditioning. We might not like even fairly mild temperatures like 106 degrees in the shade. Sorry, whoever wrote that in, but it definitely gets much, much hotter than that in the desert. It's not comfortable, but we can cope. And why can we cope? Because we sweat. And when we sweat, water comes out of our body through sweat glands, through pores, and that water evaporates. And when that water evaporates, it's essentially stealing heat away from the surface of our skin and cooling our body. So as long as we can keep that sweat going on, we can survive at temperatures 110, 115 degrees indefinitely.
You look a little bit at human history and how people began to use controlled fire for cooking, for making things, where they looked for their fuels. Take us back a bit in our relationship with heat.
Well, I'd like to take you back even further than that. Something that was very interesting to me to learn or to think about was when fire first made a presence on the Earth. So we think of the young Earth as being a very hot place, and certainly at one time it was, as rocks and things gathered together to make a planet. But there was no oxygen on the Earth for the first part of its life. And in fact, once there was oxygen started to accumulate, and then something like a mere 500 million years ago. So remember, the Earth is, about 4.5 billion years old.
Mm-hmm.
So for the first 4 billion years of its life, not enough oxygen for fire. Then about 500 million years ago, we started to have enough oxygen, but guess what? No fuel. So all that oxygen was coming from algae in the ocean. There's no fuel on land. So then plants start coming on land, evolution of plants, and you begin to accumulate fuel. And it's not until about 450 million years ago that we begin to see fire, and we begin to see a record of charcoal showing up, say, 400 million years ago on Earth. So fire, from the historical perspective of our planet, is fairly young.
And yet we've integrated it into human culture almost right at the heart of human culture.
Well, that's right. And humans today, Homo sapiens, as we call ourselves, we inherited fire from Homo erectus, one of our predecessors. So we think, to the best of our knowledge, fire was beginning to be controlled by humans somewhere between about 1.5 million years ago or so to something like 400,000 years ago by Homo erectus.
When you look at where our early ancestors traveled and their sort of choices and where they took up habitation, what does it tell you, if anything, about the human interaction with heat? I mean, these days you can look at the southern U.S. and everybody who retires there and say, oh, they're attracted, or, you know, sunbelt growth, oh, we like it. But what about when people were voting with literally their feet?
Well, I think people were driven mainly by food and water. So they would cope with the heat to some degree. They would cope with the cold, certainly once they learned to control fire and furs, and people spread out across the planet pretty effectively. But I think modern people that have choices, so our main priorities of water and food, they're pretty well squared away in most of the Western world now. So then we can make choices and we can decide where we want to live. Well, would people really live in places like Florida in the summer were it not for air conditioning? I suspect not, and you can find pretty easily journals from days gone by, pre-air conditioning days, when people said exactly that they couldn't stand the heat, and particularly the humidity. So desert heat is one thing, and you'll hear people say this, oh, it was a dry heat. Well, you know, 120 degrees, a dry heat, it's still, it's still pretty hot.
Right.
It's a dry heat, but it's still pretty hot. But at least you can sweat, and that sweat evaporates on your skin, and that's the key, that sweat evaporates. If you sweat, and it's so humid that your sweat is not evaporating, your shirt is just soaking wet, that's not really cooling you off nearly as effectively as it would if it were evaporating. And that's really the difference between a dry heat and a wet or a humid heat.
It is really interesting. We also asked on Facebook if they had to choose, you know, they'd prefer heat or cold. And people are all over the map on this thing. I mean, of course, the Center for Circumpolar Studies tells us that their vote is for the cold. Okay, we're not surprised. But we've got others who flocking to the heat here. It's just exactly where they want to be. Even even if it's tough without the AC. Michelle in Savannah, Georgia is calling, along with a lot of others. But Michelle, thanks for calling today. What's your heat experience?
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking a call.
Yeah.
I don't have any AC in my Honda.
Okay.
And in Savannah one summer, it got up to about 109. I was driving all day. I don't know how warm it was in my car, but it was so hot, my eyeballs were sweating.
Your eyeballs were sweating. Now, don't we call that tears? Were you just crying?
I thought that I was, my eyes started tearing up. And I was like, oh, there's no real reason for my eyes to tear up. It's just so hot that my eyes are sweating.
Maybe. Let us pick it up. Bill, you write about the response of the human body to heat and literally the very flesh of the human body that firefighters and others have experienced at high heat. What is that interaction?
Well, I guess first I'll say I doubt if your eyeballs were really sweating. I think you were. I think Tom had it right. You were probably crying. And I've lived in the southeastern U.S. and I've had cars without air conditioning. And I would share your tears on those really hot days when your windows are wide open and you dread the traffic light where you're going to have to stop for a minute and the wind will stop.
Yeah.
But I doubt your eyeballs were tearing. Nevertheless, I'm sure that was very, very hot. So, but your question about
firemen and others exposed to high heat and their flesh.
Yeah, well, it's a terrible thing, and I felt very strange writing about it and even talking about it here on the radio because it seems like it almost seems like a right that you have to earn. That when firefighters are burned, and that's. You know, obviously a tragic thing, but until you start to read about it and understand it, I don't think most people grasp how terrible it really is to be burned. And of course, firefighters go to great lengths to avoid being burned. Lots and lots of training and firefighters that fight wildfires carry these foil protective tents, fire shelters. They carry them on their belts. And if they're encountered by extreme heat, if they're being overrun by flames or entrapped by flames and surrounded and there's no way out, their sort of last-ditch effort at survival is to crawl into these foil fire shelter tents and let the fire burn over their position. And quite a few firefighters have survived that experience.
Not exactly fun. You describe just at the superficial level the keratin of the eyebrows sort of breaking down in super high heat on your own body.
Well, that's right. I mean, your flesh, the proteins start to lose their shape. Your flesh melts, as people call it. You fall apart.
And you've got firemen describing people they're trying to carry out of fires with those poor people literally kind of melting away in their arms.
It's really, really dreadful stuff, and that's a fairly common description among firefighters or people that have carried others out of fires that were severely burned is dripping flesh, really a dreadful expression.
Jacob in New Orleans is calling. That can get pretty soupy and warm. Jacob, also quite wonderful. Thanks for calling, Jacob. What's your story?
Hi, Tom. Yes, indeed. The weather down here can get very hot and humid, but my experience with extreme heat stems from a vacation I took with some buddies several years ago to Guatemala City. We trekked up an active volcano right outside the city, and it was terrifying when we got within about 30 yards of the actively flowing lava. I'll never forget just how your body just went into a flight mode, and we had to get out of there. We had no other option but to get out, and after we left, and later on that evening, it did feel like our skin was nearly sunburned or some sort of a sunburn, but it was terrifying.
Just the magnitude of that heat on the volcano, you take us there. Bill, you spent time on a volcano yourself and have looked at what Pliny and others looking all the way back to Vesuvius. I think yours was in Hawaii.
That's right, yeah, and I also got very close to lava. I know exactly what Jacob is talking about. It is quite an experience, and I was fortunate in being on the volcano with a very experienced geologist, so I could take some chances that I certainly wouldn't have taken on my own. But one thing that I experienced, and I'm sure Jacob did as well, you're very dependent on which way the wind is crossing that live lava. And if the wind changes directions and brings that heat directly towards you, it's sort of like opening an oven times 10. And Jacob mentioned that they felt as though they might have been sunburned or something after his experience, and they quite possibly were. They might have had minor burns on their skin just from being close to that fire.
What kind of temperatures does a volcano bring to the surface in its lava?
Well, I think I was measuring temperatures of liquid lava on the surface at about 1,600 degrees, 1,600 Fahrenheit. But it varies. You know, it really varies. It depends on how far down into the lava you are, how fast it's coming to the surface. By the time I was close to it, it had time to be on the surface and to cool off.
I mean, that sounds really hot. On the other hand, early on in your book, you're using an electronic thermometer. You're aiming it at just a candle's flame. And as I recall, you recorded that at something like 1,300 degrees.
That's right. Parts of a candle flame or a wood fire would also be up that high, but also parts of a candle flame would be cooler than that. So it depends on where you are in the flame, and that's true of fires. It's going to be true of lava. It's true of almost anything that's hot won't be uniformly hot. And that's why, you know, you've probably seen pictures taken with infrared cameras, pictures of fire scenes and that kind of thing. And those are not a uniform color, and that's because that flame, that fire, is different temperatures in different places.
Let's get a call from Michael in Windsor, Vermont. Michael, what do you know of heat?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm sitting here behind a hot little engine on a cold dirt road in Vermont, and I wanted to offer a question or a clarification. I'm hearing you talk about temperature and heat as though they're the same thing, and I don't think they are. I think that temperature is just a measurement of the movement of molecules, and heat's something completely different. I mean, I'm surrounded by snow here on this dirt road, and there's a lot of heat in that, even though the temperature may be low. And, you know, I think about when we would, you know, when things change state, that when an ice cube melts,
mm-hmm.
you may still continue to add heat to it with a lighter or a stove, but its temperature doesn't change during that change of state. And so if they were the same thing, they would both increase. But so just a friendly clarification, and I hope I'm correct that temperature and heat are not the same thing.
From a cold road in Vermont with a hot engine running, Bill Strieber, how about it, that distinction that our caller makes?
No, he's absolutely right. Temperature and heat are not the same thing. And, you know, one of the interesting things he mentioned is if you take a block of ice and you warm that block of ice up, so you might have a block of ice that starts out at a very cold temperature, maybe a block of ice at minus 40 degrees Fahrenheit, and you start adding heat, so you start adding energy to this system. So you're bringing the temperature of this thing up, and if you're adding heat steadily, that heat increases steadily until it starts to melt. And then, or the temperature increases steadily until it starts to melt. When it starts to melt, the temperature stops increasing, even though you're still adding heat, until it's completely melted, and then the water starts to increase in temperature.
Bill Strieber's new book is Heat: Adventures in the World's Fiery Places. Here are the presidents of the United States of America with Volcano. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about heat, what it is, where we find it, and how much we can take. Bill Strieber is with us. He's author of the new book, Heat: Adventures in the World's Fiery Places. I think I've got the sound of little bacon sizzling somewhere here, just to remind us of how it can all work. Bill joins us from Anchorage, Alaska today, and you can join us as well. What's your heat story, good or bad? What's your heat question? There's been plenty of heat in Australia lately. This month they've been dealing with heat waves and wildfires. We've got here an Australian reporter for Al Jazeera, Andrew Thomas, reporting on Australia's piping hot fires last week.
The fire authorities called conditions catastrophic, an official term they used to describe the combination of heat, wind and dry vegetation likely to produce devastating wildfires. Temperatures across New South Wales rose above 40 degrees Celsius, more than 100 degrees Fahrenheit, Winds picked up speed, increasing the risk of flames being spun from one area to another.
And spin they have in a very hot Australia. It has been rough. On the other hand, nice fireplace can be marvelous. A little sound right there of a good fire. Bill Strever, we've got lots of response from our listeners. Blue says, you know, what's the greatest heat you've ever experienced? Walking off a plane onto the tarmac in Hong Kong many years ago, about 100 degrees and so humid. Blue writes, I lost my breath and felt nauseous. Heat knocks me out. I'm not looking forward to a global warming future. We'll talk about that. Sonia says, the late 80s, a heat wave in Chicago, many days in a row above 110. Usually I go gray-green at 85, but when it cooled down to 98, I was comfortable. She said, you know, sometimes it's all about the relative heat. Stephen writes to us, says, my most dramatic encounter with heat was as a firefighter at a burning garage where the glass in the windows softened and rolled out off the window frames like fruit roll-ups. At the same fire, not 10 feet away on the cement floor, sat a couple of large cans of gasoline that remained intact through the whole thing. He says, firefighting shows the unbelievable. I guess minor variations in how the heat is hitting what can make a big difference. You would think the gasoline would be up in flames, but there it was not, Bill.
That's right. Yeah, you know, that's an interesting thing. I visited a house that had burned or mostly burned. The majority of the house was gutted. Most of the roof was gone. The bathroom somehow survived, and the shower curtain, one of these cheap plastic shower curtains that we've all seen, was still hanging there untouched in a house that otherwise had entirely burned.
So how do you account for that? Some kind of draft that took the heat in a different direction? Or?
Yeah, I imagine so. It's if you watch inside of your fireplace or in a campfire or in a wood stove and watch how the fire burns and watch how it dances around and moves around. And there are certainly places, even in an enclosed fireplace, an enclosed wood stove, there are certainly places that are much, much cooler than other places. So sometimes certain places just get lucky, and you see the same thing in windstorms, right? You see the same thing in tornadoes, one area devastated, and yeah, right next to it, something sitting on the ground that by all rights should have blown away.
Let's get a call from Lauren, calling from New Orleans, Louisiana. Lauren, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well. What's your story?
I'm good. Well, I'm a welder. I was welding while I was on hold. And also, I work with a blacksmith, and I do iron casting.
Okay. And, welding on hold. I love that image. That's just great.
Correct.
Welding on hold.
Well, so I'm wondering how the human body actually adapts to heat. Like, I work with heat every day, and it's gotten to the point where I'm not as sensitive as I used to be, I think. And I'm just wondering about how your nerves actually react to heat over time and how people that aren't really exposed to extremes, like, tend not to be able to deal with them.
How about it, Bill? You know? Can you shed some light on that? Do we acclimate to extreme heat?
We acclimate to a degree, but not nearly as much as most people think. And I think there's a psychology involved, of course, and probably with welders, probably most of what you're experiencing is a psychology. You get accustomed to it. You know what to expect. You know it'll go away. So your mind starts to say, oh, okay, well, that's all right. I can deal with this. But the main ways that people adapt to heat in terms of weather, so say you go to Death Valley in July, which I highly recommend. I think it's a great experience. Go there July, go there in August. But one of the things you'll find yourself doing very quickly is discovering that the wardrobe you came with is probably not the wardrobe that you want.
Yeah.
That's one thing you'll discover. Another thing you'll discover is that drinking lots of water and drinking water before you're thirsty really makes a world of difference. And people that aren't accustomed to being around heat, that's something they don't do. And welding, so for a welder, for example, a welder will learn subconsciously or consciously very quickly if they're welding every day. They'll learn to take on lots of water around that heat. You'll also learn to do things like to turn your body sideways to the sun so you're exposing as little of your body as possible to the sun. And most people don't even realize they're doing it, but they do it. And so do animals. If you watch a coyote, for example, in the desert, they'll often turn their body to expose the narrow part of the body to the sun instead of a broadside to the sun.
Richard in Newton, Massachusetts. Richard, thanks for calling.
Hello. I'm calling about entropy. I mean, the most important thing that people don't understand about heat is that it is stored in the molecular order of fuel molecules. And then when you release heat from storage in order, no matter how efficiently you use it in some engine, you always create more waste than you create work. And using fuel is always a question of getting rid of the excess heat. And the concept of entropy is once it actually describes the loss of order rather than the loss of either matter or energy. And so entropy became the basis of information theory, which is the basis of our computer age. So a big transformation happened in around 1860 when entropy was described as the only quantity in the universe that is not conserved. So entropy becomes the arrow of time. And so I'm just curious because we're talking about heat, and the most important thing about heat is the second law of thermodynamics, and it deserves an honorable mention anyway.
Absolutely. Richard, how do you make the leap there from entropy and heat to information theory? If that's the fundament of it, what's the connection?
Well, Claude Shannon, who was who described information entropy, mm-hmm. so that an expression called Shannon entropy, for example, is used by Google to complete your searches on, and also have voice recognition work, because Shannon entropy in language science predicts the third word, the most likely third word you're going to say after any two words, believe it or not. And that's the probability algorithm that allows speech recognition to work and all information theory to work. And wow. It's all about the idea that disorder is quantifiable.
The world, it's just a kind of mind-boggling. The world is such an amazingly interrelated pace, all hail the second law of thermodynamics there. Richard, I'm so glad you called. I mean, Bill, did you track this path from the heart of heat and entropy to information theory?
No, that sounds like a great topic for another book. Maybe the title would be Disorder.
Yeah, once you're hot enough. Richard, thank you very much for that. That's going to give us plenty to ponder right there. We've got, closer to home, we've got NJ asking about heat and cooking. What's actually happening in the molecular level in foods that are cooked? I know you did go there, Bill.
Yeah, I did go there. In fact, someone else went there and created an entire new science in the 1990s, which is a relatively young science, the science of molecular gastronomy. I believe his name was Hermé Tisse. He's a Frenchman. And he worked with another person whose name escapes me at the moment. But rather than looking at sort of cooking as an art, they looked at cooking as a science, and they asked questions like, what happens when I boil an egg? And what's the difference between a 2-minute egg and a 3-minute egg? Well, it turns out the difference is actually the temperature of the egg. And you can boil an egg in a temperature-controlled bath. You can boil an egg for as long as you want, and as long as you keep it at a particular temperature, you will get the exact same egg resulting. And if you boil it at 2 or 3 degrees warmer, you'll get a very different egg. And with that little piece of work, they started this this trend, at least in some parts of the world, in Paris especially, I think, for people ordering eggs cooked to a particular temperature rather than ordering the 3-minute egg or the 2-minute egg. You would order an egg at a particular temperature, and you would know exactly what you're going to get. And a lot of what they're looking at is how the proteins change at different temperatures, how protein structures start to unravel and break down at different temperatures.
I'm telling you, my kitchen is not that sophisticated, and yet we like the eggs. Ivan in Southbury, Connecticut. Ivan, thanks for calling. You're on the air with Bill Strieber.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. The question I have is, if heat is really molecular motion, then how can we have heat inside the super collider where there are no molecules, barely any atoms? And how can we be talking about heat or the temperature at Big Bang when there isn't even any matter? I don't quite understand that.
Bill, can you run with that?
I can try to run with that, but I think what we're pretty quickly going to get into our normal ideas, our normal model of the universe, of our normal model of the world that we have in our minds breaking down. So I talk about molecular motion being heat, heat being an expression of molecular motion at sort of, quote-unquote, normal temperatures, at the temperatures where we normally function. And as we get hotter and hotter and we start to get up to temperatures, certainly by the time we're in the trillions of degrees, we're no longer talking, as the caller said, about molecular motion. Now you're talking about a more a different form of energy. It's no longer expressed as molecular motion because there are no molecules, but there's other particles. So there's things like quarks. Even after the protons are gone, you still have these other particles called quarks.
And so we get into the real subtleties of heat as we get out into those trillions. Sand, calling from New Orleans. Sand, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I have a 200-year-old plantation house. And one of the things that we look at, since I work in historic preservation, is how people did live in our extremely hot and humid climate. And when you look at the design of the houses, what you find is they were so clever. They really paid attention to the organic nature of the materials that were used. The houses are raised off the ground, and the ground floor or the foundations were built of porous clay that was dug from the Mississippi River.
Mm-hmm.
That allowed these bricks to absorb ground moisture. So this wicking process would bring the moisture up. The houses themselves were built out of cypress, which of course is a native wood that mm-hmm. grows in water. So it also would absorb that moisture. As the breeze blew through the house, it would evaporate that moisture and help to cool it down. The Venturi effect, which uses this funneling of the breeze through the house, the houses themselves also had multiple doors. The early houses had no hallways in them, so you had full cross ventilation, and this would help to cool and create a more tolerable environment.
Sam, that's just fabulous. I mean, that subtlety, that nuance of how people so long ago used materials from their environment so knowingly to deal with heat. It's kind of incredible, isn't it, Sand?
It is. It's truly remarkable. And you know, people have asked me about, living, of course, 200 years ago and how they coped. And I always said, well, part of it was trying to keep their sanity because the heat and humidity here, we don't have those extreme temperatures you're mm-hmm. talking about.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it's rare for us to get to 100 degrees in New Orleans. But when it's 95 and 95% humidity, you just are stifled. It's like moving in slow motion.
But human ingenuity at work vividly there long before air conditioning. What about that trail of our ingenuity in dealing with heat over the centuries, the millennia, Bill? I mean, we humans have just focused on this quite incredibly.
But we haven't, and I really like that call. I like what she's saying about these old houses and the way people coped with the heat. And they built a house that essentially the house was sweating and the house was cooling itself.
For them, around them, yeah.
Around them, that's right. And also I like the caller's point about the 95 degrees being very, very hot if it's humid. And I sort of mentioned that earlier. If sweat doesn't evaporate off your skin, it's not cooling you off. And the inside of your body temperature is raising probably quicker than it would if you were in a desert with a very dry heat and you were well hydrated and water was evaporating off of your skin. So she's absolutely right. Those kind of temperatures are just terrible to deal with. And one adaptation we have, I mentioned before, is we adapt our behavior. And I think people in those very hot climates without air conditioning, they adjusted when they did when they exerted themselves, when they did hard physical activity, wasn't during the hottest part of the day.
You know, her old house worked with the heat. It was a kind of a coping machine. Take it to a planetary level. You do pay attention, some attention here to climate change. What are you anticipating on that front? And if that comes with more punch of heat, how do we deal?
Well, we'll have to adapt as we go forward, as humans have done throughout our time on Earth. I guess, you know, I still see lots of argument about is climate change happening or not. And in the book, I didn't want this book to be about climate change. I wanted the book to be about heat and about high temperatures. But I couldn't write a book like this without talking about climate change. So I go through some of the history of it. And, you know, one message I really want people to take from this book in terms of climate change is that it's not a new idea. People have been thinking about climate change and about carbon dioxide and other gases and how they essentially trap heat on Earth since the 1800s.
Yeah, but you write that they once welcomed it. We may have overshot the degree that they would welcome at this point.
Well, that's absolutely right. So the early scientists working on this, they were mainly interested in understanding, once the world realized that there had been ice ages in our past, the next question was, well, what happened to those ice ages and why did that happen? So they started looking into this and they said pretty quickly with some experiments in the mid-1800s, I think 1861, some experiments that looked at carbon dioxide passing through a four-foot-long tube and how that trapped heat. And the scientist Tyndall certainly welcomed the coming warmer temperatures. He saw that as a positive thing, easier to grow crops.
We may be well beyond what he anticipated and addressing the heat that comes with that passage.
Bill Streber, that's right. It brings with its own problems.
No kidding. This is quite a tour, Bill, and we've only scratched the surface of it. I'm grateful to you for spending a little hot hour with us today. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Well, thank you, and thanks to all your callers. Thanks, Tom.
Bill Streber, author of Heat, Adventures in the World's Fiery Places, speaking of which, we'll talk in this hour tomorrow about Mali and what's blowing up there right now. We'll go out with little Ingrid Michaelson and fire. Stay cool or warm, whatever suits you on this winter's day. Thanks for your time. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. See you tomorrow.